Welcome to UW-Madison Campus Voices. Our mission is to capture, present, and preserve some of the strongest historical stories and memories of UW-Madison through the people who live them. Campus Voices, a project of the UW-Madison Archives and Records Management Services, consists of presenting extant archival material in 21st century publishable formats. The following clips have been selected from a collection of over 25 interviews that comprise the UW Oral History Program series on the Madison LGBT community from 1960 to the present. Alongside these clips, our historical consultant Scott Seiforth will be providing narration. These audio and visual resources were created in collaboration by Molly Kahn, a graduate student in the Library Sciences program, and myself, Kristen Schumacher, an undergraduate here at UW. This project is funded in part by a grant from the New Harvest Foundation, Incorporated, and we would like to thank them for their outstanding generosity.
In 1962, I sat in the campus security office at the University of Wisconsin and waited for the man behind the desk to stop shuffling his papers. Finally, he raised his head and stared at me. "I'm sure you don't know why you were called in today," he said. "You're wrong," I said. "I do know. You're conducting a purge of homosexuals on campus." "What?" he shouted. "Who told you that? They all promised right here in this office not to say a word." You see, this man was already beginning to disintegrate. "Well, someone broke his promise," I said. "It's not a purge," he said. "It's an investigation."
Chapter 1, 1962, The Campus Gay Purge, as told by Lewis Bosworth and UW alum and author George Stambolian in an episode of the cable access television program Nothing to Hide.
Throughout 1962, the Department of Protection and Security and the Dean of Men's Office conducted a full-scale investigation of gay men at UW-Madison. And they called in men that they thought to be gay, and they told them to name other men who were gay, and by coercing these gay male students to provide names of other gay men, they compiled a list of over 200 gay men on campus.
I was at home in my apartment one day, in 1962, as a sophomore, I believe, and the phone rang, and it was one of my grad student friends speaking to me in French, which was perfectly okay, but not usual. And he explained to me that there was this purge going on behalf of the university to rid the university of gay male students. There was a dean of men, Ted Zillman was his name, who decided to take one or two young men, undergraduate men, into his office and question them about their sexual behavior.
The dean of men at the time believed that, you know, graduating, you know, gay men into the world, avowed gay men, openly gay men, into the world was a blemish on the institution. And he wanted to weed out potential gay graduates that he believed would reflect badly on Madison.
Since I was ignoring them, a detective from the university police at the time came to my place of employment, which happened to have been the University of Wisconsin Hospital, and literally had my nursing supervisor pull me out of an operating room into the corridor and threatened me with not appearing before university officials as requested. And so I finally kind of gave in. And I did go to the dean of men's office.
So at that time, you didn't need to actually do anything to be kicked out. You just had to be gay. You had to say you were gay. You had to claim being gay.
I have affidavits here, signed affidavits from five men who said they had sexual relations with you. They're lying, I say. "You know who these people are? They're homosexuals," he yelled. "And they do terrible things." "Such as what?" "Awful things, disgusting things," he said. "Give me an example," I said. "Well, they write things on the walls in men's rooms." When he said that, I almost collapsed. "Well, they write things on the walls of men's rooms." "I thought football players did that," I said. "Are you a homosexual?" he asked. "No." "You're lying," he said. "Then I'm just like all the others," I said.
If the man admitted he was gay, the university would call his parents, take away his scholarship, and expel him. And the purge led to an investigation of other faculty and staff and other deans on campus. And it became quite a big deal. And, you know, it ruined a lot of people's careers. It ruined your ability to, you know, transfer to another school. They wouldn't provide, you know, a recommendation for you to be admitted to another school. And so for a lot of people, it cut off their ability to, you know, be a professional.
So the downside in my experience with that, one of the downsides, was I had been accepted to a program abroad, a junior year abroad kind of program, and I had received, as a result of having been accepted to the very first year of that program, a tuition remission scholarship, which meant that I could pay in-state tuition instead of out-of-state tuition because I was actually technically from out-of-state. Well, they reneged on that. They took away the scholarship. So my parents did, in fact, have to pay out-of-state tuition for the year that I was abroad.
It went on through 1963, and only started to stop partly through the intervention of the counseling service and the director of the counseling service at the time, who stepped in to say that the purge was causing, you know, more harm to the university community than good. They were seeing this uptick of men who were, you know, having a lot of emotional problems because of the way they were being harassed by the university.
Yes, but what sticks in one's craw is that I lied to save myself. I did not lie incriminating others, as some people have done. I lied to save myself, and I succeeded. It was thanks to the fact that I was prepared, that I had the presence of mind to do that. At the time, it seemed like the only way to do it. But don't forget, the only way we could survive in those days was by lying, and was by secrecy. And as the years passed, that began to grate on me more and more. And it grates on you to such a point that when the day comes when you decide, I am not going to lie again, you see, you remember,
yes,
that moment of self-denial, and I say, no, I'll never do that again. I'll never, ever do that again.
So when you came here, did you know people?
No.
Other people? So how did you go about?
Well, this is the largest city next to Dayton.
Right. But how did
and
you go about?
It's not that big of a city. Well,
finding
to me
a community.
It was. I went to the gay bars.
Okay.
Chapter 2, The 1960s and the Emergence of Madison's Bar Culture, as told by DJ Whipperfirth and Louis Bosworth.
Well, you know, it used to be in the 60s and in the 50s that, you know, there were no gay bars. There was no place to go that would allow you to be gay. But like the 602 Club, which is now Wando's, used to be, you know, had an arrangement where, you know, the gay men would gather at the bar, in front of the bar itself, at the front of the establishment. And then the tables in the back were for the straight clientele. And then there were other bars that became gay after like 11 o'clock at night.
Tell me about that. What was that like? And any bars that you could
remember?
Well,
they weren't really gay bars, except, well, the Velvet Swing was a gay bar, and so was the Pirate Ship. The Pirate Ship was later, though. The Velvet Swing was at first.
And so were they primarily gay bars, or were they...
They were men's bars.
Okay, they were men's
bars. Men's gay bars, and okay. Women always congregated in the back around the pool tables. Back then, pinball machines, stuff like that. We had our little group meetings there, and we did our thing. Three Bells it was called. It was a street bar on University Avenue in the 800 block, which would have been Park and University, right by Humanities Building, across the street from where Humanities is now. And the... It was, it's where all the flyboys, the gay flyboys, would come from Truett's Field down to the Three Bells. And lesbians sometimes used to meet in this one back corner of the bar where there was these booths. And we'd be there, and the flyboys would be in the other side of the bar in this back corner. And the rest of the bar was straight, college students.
After the gay liberation movement started, you know, in 1969, the gay community really wanting a place that would allow them to be who they were, actually went and approached the Pirate Ship, which was a bar, which is up on the block that now is the Overture Center. But it was called the Pirate Ship, and it had a big mural of a pirate ship. And it had, you know, netting, and it was decorated like a mansion. And the gay community approached the pirate ship and asked if, you know, they could congregate at the pirate ship. And the pirate ship agreed.
Patty Rupp, she had the boys over to the pirate ship. So then we had the three bells, a bell between the pirate ship and the stoplight. So this town, for as small as it is, has always had a lot of places for gay people to go, because we were always welcome in straight bars. Yeah, I mean, we got tired of this business all the time of going to where the men drank. And Nancy Trotter, she decided one day up there, Jack McManus owned this little bar on the corner of Butler and Wilson Street. And he's a famous criminal lawyer here in town. And all the lawyers would go there and have sandwiches for lunch and stuff and what have you. And when the courts closed, the lawyers would go out, either out to eat to fancy restaurants or fancier bars, and the place would be dead all night. So she was a lesbian. She started inviting us gals down to the bar. So we kind of took it over, and then the lawyers had started to tease Jack. He said, you know, you got all them girls hanging around down there, but they aren't our kind of girls, Jack. What's going on down there at bar years? And he'd say, oh, the girls got to... They always call us girls.
Uh-huh.
All the girls got to have some place to go. He didn't give a damn. Besides, all of a sudden, this little bar, he had so much money, he could care less if it made money. But all of a sudden, it started making money at night, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, he told Nancy one time, he said, since you invited all the girls down here, he said, this isn't a tax write-off anymore.
Oh, for losses.
He was doing business from 10 in the morning all the way through bar time.
But the trouble is there was nowhere to dance. So the gay community was still frustrated because they didn't have a place where you could really, you know, be in that way and where other people got to be, right? Because who doesn't like to dance? So a man by the name of Rodney Scheel in 1972, at the age of 21, opened a bar called The Back Door. It was at 46 North Park Street, just right two blocks from where we're sitting. And it was the first exclusively gay bar in Madison's history. It was the first bar owned and operated by a gay person for the gay community. It was a bar and a dance club and a home away from home for many of the newly liberated gay men and women and their friends of that era.
And then I got a job part-time. The Back Door opened. The Back Door was wonderful.
I remember that bar.
Rodney Scheel. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a place where he could dance with his lover, Warren Olson. So they opened the Back Door, then this college bar that was across the street, I forget the name of the damn place. The bartenders would get them liquored up, and they'd say, get them all liquored up and riled up, and they'd come over to beat up the queers, you know.
Oh.
So they'd come down, you literally had to come down the back stairs, down the Back Door. And I'd be tending bar down there, and they'd come in there, and they'd start raising hell. And oddly enough, you know, Mika Alberici, she's just this really small woman. Lucky she's 100 pounds wet, and when the shit would hit the fan, the men would sit in their little booths, scared as hell, and the women would come and watch my back. And here's little Mika swinging a pool cue. I got your back, Deej, I got your back. She was right in there. And then, of course, there was always Phil. He was about 6'5". He was this tall, slender drag queen. He would always be up with us women fighting.
Oh.
You know, and I remember one time he had one of these characters, they'd fired an ashtray or a beer bottle or something at the mirror behind the bar and broke it. And they were yelling obscenities at all us and stuff. And Phil come flying out of his stool, and he slammed him up against the wall, and he kind of picked him up off the ground a little bit, you know, and he said, you know, there's nothing worse than an angry queen. Have you ever been hit with a high heel? I'll never forget that. I don't know why I remember it now, but I'll never forget it. By then, police were more educated.
Okay.
They'd come down and they'd say, what's going on? And I'd say, it's the kids from across the street again. They were yelling, and we got into fights, and they never arrested any of us. And these kids would get really angry. Well, they hit us, or they did this, or she hit me with a pool cue, or she, which she did, Mika.
Andy. But they never arrested any of you.
None
they
of
arrest
us.
The kids?
Because they said, you came down here to hassle these people, and you need to leave them alone. We're sick of coming here for this. and you're going to jail.
So describe the back door, entering the back door, and what the... What
well, happened. When you entered the back door via the back door, the first thing you came upon was a grand or baby grand piano in a little coat room kind of place, and then a very small location physically. And then you would go down some steps, and where the bar, the main bar, was, and a couple of restrooms, and you know, it wasn't a large place physically, but it was accessible and popular.
You know, there were few bars that were welcoming to the Madison lesbian community in the 1970s. You know, the Stoplight and the Cosmo Club and Your Place were straight bars that sort of had a lesbian following. But in 1973, a group of lesbians approached Rodney Scheel about having a dedicated lesbian night at the back door, and Rodney agreed, and then Thursday nights throughout the 70s then became Women's Night at the back doors, which was a big tradition during that era.
Chapter 3, Rodney Scheel and the Famous Hotel Washington, as told by Louis Bosworth, Alex Pop, and Martha Olson.
So Rodney operates the back door through the 70s, and in 1975, he buys the property that is Hotel Washington, that becomes Hotel Washington. And the first thing that he runs there is he continues a cafe that is open on the main floor, and he, a eatery there, and he renames it the Hot L Cafe after a 70s show that was on at that time called the Hot L Baltimore, which was about a cafe in Baltimore. And this television show was important to the gay community at the time because it was the first television show on network TV that had a recurring gay character. And then he goes about over the course of the next, well, until he dies, completely reinventing the inside of this building as it into multiple venues. It becomes a complex, kind of a remarkable complex, unlike any place in Madison, unlike any place almost anywhere. After the Hot L, the next thing that they open is a bar in the basement called the Barber's Closet. It was located down an exterior stairwell, and you went through a door into a small room that appeared to go nowhere, like you were trapped. But if you looked, you could open a secret panel through which you entered into the actual Barber's Closet.
Yeah, I remember that great door that you'd open up, and that was a very romantic place.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, it's where you went for your serious date or...
Yeah.
So they continue renovating the inside of this place. Then he opens in the basement another bar called Rod's. It's in the basement of the building. It was, in the parlance of its day, it was a leather Levi bar. And he ended up creating a big outdoor patio out the back of the bar that was very popular in the summer. And then they had a big dance floor in the back room and another room that showed adult male videos. And it became a very popular destination for men, you know, throughout Wisconsin and northern Illinois. And then they went up and they completely, over the next few years, they completely gutted several of the top two floors and took out everything and then built in its, you know, in this big empty cavern of a space, a big dance bar.
Then he opened the another part of our history. Certainly, what was called, I'm always aghast at the fact that when people call things something and the name sticks, even though it's completely meaningless. For example, Rodney decided on the third floor of his hotel building, he would open a new bar. And till the day the building burned down, it was still called the New Bar, the New Bar. And it was a dancing place, and many people may remember it. So I and my late partner used to hang out there, and we would watch Jeopardy, one of our favorite things. So we had Rod's in the basement, and then we had the New Bar, which remained the New Bar. And then behind Rod's in the basement, we had the Back Bar. So there were actually three places in the building that could have been decidedly called gay bars.
They had a music venue in a bar in the on the first floor in the back that was called Club de Wash that hosted different bands every night of the week. They had a micro cafe, a micro bar. They had an espresso bar. They had 10 permanent rooms for residents and 22, they kept some of the hotel rooms, and they had 22 hotel rooms for guests because people would come in from around the state and up. People would come up from Chicago. You know, it was a destination. Yeah, Hotel Washington burned to the ground in a fire on February 18, 1996. And that's what happened. I think the report is that somebody emptied a cigarette into a trash can. You know, cigarette butts into a trash can. And that was the end of the Hotel Wash. Rodney Shield died of AIDS in 1990. And his brother took over the running of the management of the bar. And there were efforts when it burnt down in 1996 to have it rebuilt, but they just, none of them came to fruition.
What we decided to do was, Martha actually had this idea. We went down there one day after everything was out and it was just a pile of rubble, and someone had hung the flag. Someone brought it up from Chicago, didn't they? Wasn't that the story?
Well, we had had it when we had the things at Brittingham Park. Remember, they used to bring that out for Pride.
The big one, yeah.
Yeah, the big one, and they'd throw it up and down, and mm-hmm. when they used to have the purse run and the...
the high heel.
The relays.
Yeah. So we saw that, and she's, you know, you
someone
said
draped it over.
We need to just memorialize this somehow. And so we ended up taking a photograph of it. And then we had 1,000 posters printed up of that photograph.
Oh, you're the ones who did that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, we took it to a place down in McFarland that printed it for us.
Wells Printing.
Yep. And
we decided we would have it as a fundraiser so that if anything ever came back from the ashes of that, we wanted there to be mm-hmm. a meeting place. Actually, we were hoping it would be for teens and young mm-hmm. people. Because we thought that that was the most important thing, is that they would have a place to go and mm-hmm. meet in the city mm-hmm. that would be safe and would be fun and would be social. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, we sold all of them except one. We have one left.
Chapter 4, Creating a Women's Space. Lysistrata opens in 1977. As told by DJ Whipperfirth, Liz Lenski, Alex Pop, and Martha Olson.
We were all sitting around commiserating that the only places we had to go to is bars, and a lot of times I say, but whose fault is that? That's ours. We don't do anything about it. You know, then they started, the lesbian potluck started out of all that stuff. Some women got that idea and started that and started having it transferred around to different homes and stuff, and then Catherine put together the works to put together Lysistrata. Hmm.
Lysistrata was a gathering place for the Madison feminist community. It offered a multi-purpose space for socializing, entertainment, and meeting. You know, and events at Lysistrata included poetry readings, candidates' receptions, issue debates, films, lectures, dances, benefits for local women's causes. And there was food. It was a restaurant. And a wonderful restaurant. The food was delicious and it was healthy. It had the first salad bar in Madison. The first Madison Take Back the Night March is planned at Lysistrata in 1978. Lysistrata was a place where women made friends and lovers and change in their community. It was a women's restaurant, bar, and performance space that was developed by the Lysistrata Cooperative, whose board included Carla Dubinsky, a lawyer in town, Kay Clarenbach, one of the founders of the National Organization for Women, and a professor on campus, Ruth Blyer, who was a professor on campus, Catherine Rouse, and Andrea Motz-Stelling, and Janet Brewer.
Thursday night was Women's Night at Lysistrata. And then frequently, you know, that was a definite night that I'd go dancing every Thursday and often on the weekends. Lysistrata at that time was positioned as a feminist restaurant and bar collective and appealed to a wider community of men and women, but I hung out there a lot, and it was a wonderful environment. It was a beautiful, you know, light wood, lots of windows. It was at a time where the police and fire departments were recruiting women. A lot of the women who hung out at Lysistrata were the first recruiting classes for police cadets and the fire department, and A lot of different women's organizations had their meetings at Liz Estrada. So it was really a place to go to meet the community of women in Madison, and it had definitely more of a political bent to it. There were other bars, women's bars and gay bars in Madison at the time, but Liz Estrada was really more, it still maintained its sort of feminist definition.
And there were certain days or nights, I can't remember, where you dress up. Remember Mary Bennett and a bunch of us dressed up to be waitresses one night in some kind of vintage costumes. Mm-hmm. And there were so many activities from there. It really was the hub.
It was great. Yeah. Some nights I'd cocktail waitress out at the tables when they had like the fancy dress-up stuff like you're talking about. Every time it was just straight bartending. Ed Durkin, who was then the chief of the fire chief, he'd come in all the time with Gene Parks. I'd always serve Gene gin because that was his drink. I mean, it was just like this incredible place where people came. It's just like when you first come to town, everybody goes to a room, you know, and sort of like to get hooked up. Well, people came to Liz Estrada for the same reason.
And again, a fire destroyed Liz Estrada and four other adjoining businesses on January 8, 1982, and left the local feminist community bereft. Arson investigators concluded that the blaze was intentionally set, but no suspect was ever arrested. The building was connected to four other businesses, and it was the press reports at the time suspect that it was one of the other business owners or one of those other businesses that set the fire, so that it was not intentionally trying to burn down Liz Estrada, but maybe trying to burn down a different business.
Chapter 5, Activist Movements Begin, as told by DJ Whipperfirth, Kathleen Nichols, and clips from the cable access television program Nothing to Hide.
It was still the tail end of the anti-war movement, and so you also have to backdrop this into what else is going on campus, because Madison really was one of the most radical campuses in North America. So when I'm sort of talking about what we were doing, it was all happening in a climate that was nothing short of fervid. One of the funnier days was the day we liberated the Red Gym. The Red Gym was still the gym, and it had a big old swimming pool in the middle. And it was actually a very popular cruising spot for the boys because men got to swim nude in the pool. But, you know, we ardent feminists were having none of this. Guys have a swimming pool and the girls do not have a swimming pool. So a clutch of us, including the extremely highly regarded Professor Blyer, we went running into the Red Gym. In bathing suits. And there's a, you know, pool full of naked guys. And the guys all jump out of the pool and run away. Of course, if they just remained in the pool, nothing would have been hanging in the wind. But oh my God, the pool emptied. We had just, you know, busted the all-male club. So that was one of the funnier days.
Then we started to get involved in other things, take back the night marches and things like that, women's issues that were important, really important.
What about
and then you'd get these crazy women sometimes that just get nuts because us lesbians felt the same way they did. They just were bananas. Drive me nuts. They'd say, oh, well, you know, this one woman one time said, oh, what do you lesbians know about take back the night? And I thought, I'm a woman. That's all I need to know. Not all of them were like that. Mm-hmm. Just a few crackerjacks. Mm-hmm. But so things started to get convoluted. Started to get strange between. But then that calmed down after they got to know us a little better.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we started to have our own activists like Barbara Leitner and Margot. Oh, I forget their names now. None of them live here anymore. Patty Dudley and some of these women that would, like, work really incessantly hard to get a lot of this stuff changed and turned around and stuff at center and what have you. And people like Sue Goldwoman would bring about, like, her infant variety, the radio show, and have women's music and a lot of times it'd be lesbians that sing their songs for women, women towards women, and all that stuff started to blossom more.
So now we're in the beginning of the 80s, and there was this spate of just hideous homophobic movies, Cruising with Al Pacino, and Windows with Elizabeth Montgomery and Talia Shire as her innocent victim. So we're organizing pickets and protests of Cruising and Windows, and there was a theater, the Foursquare Theater, and so this demonstration is happening at the Foursquare Theater, and the boys really did get rowdy. And so Barbara and I are canoodling on the couch, and the 10 o'clock news comes on, and it's saying that there have been arrests. I really come from the Saul Alinsky School of Organizing, that if you get two people or three people or four people arrested in a political demonstration, you must get 20 people arrested. So I spent the next day calling around to Lesbian Switchboard and the Right Crisis Center and the Battered Women's Shelter and Carla Davinsky's Law Office, or getting women who, and guys, but most of them, who will agree to protest the movie at the Easttown Theater, because we've closed down Foursquare, so it's only being shown in Easttown. And so we go to Easttown, and we're locked arms, and, you know, we're organizing, we have legal observers, and we're planning on getting about 40 people arrested. But then Attorney General Jim Doyle agrees with the request of the owners of the Easttown property that we get charged not with ordinance violation trespassing, but we get charged with a Class D or E felony under state trespassing provision. And so a number of the people who are intending to get arrested who were in law school or pre-med, a felony conviction will prevent them. And so a whole lot of folks get up and leave. But, you know, we still have a relatively substantial group, so we lock arms. And so, you know, so we each go limp, and we have to all be carried out, and I still recall the female police officer making sure my skirt was down over my knees, and we get put in the Black Maria and taken off to the Who's Gal.
Chapter 6, The AIDS Epidemic and the Madison AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, as told using clips from the cable access television show Nothing to Hide and by Steve Starkey.
Well, the first confirmed case of AIDS is reported in Wisconsin in August of 1983. And the Madison AIDS support group gets off the ground in 1984, led by Chaz Pope. And it starts as an off-campus group. They meet at the Gay Center and in November of 1984. And that sort of is the beginning of the community response to the AIDS pandemic.
Another organization, well-known gay organization that I was part of, was called Galvanize. And that was a pride march. It was the organization that put on the pride march. I think they started organizing in 88. You know, people around the country, there were other gay marches that were happening, gay parades that were happening, and so there was enough of a community at that point that people, various people and groups and organizations said we should have a march. And the first effort was really big, and it was a whole week long thing. And they did it in conjunction with maybe it was AIDS Network or one of the AIDS organizations in town. And I remember they brought the quilt. So they did it at Camp Randall, and I remember they had a huge section of the quilt on the floor, and people, and that was when the AIDS quilt was first, had been made and was touring the country, and so it was kind of a big deal having it here. And so there were several events during a whole week-long series of activities, and then culminating with the march.
One of the reasons that it's so important for AIDS patients to be as aware as they can be about the disease is that early on, like in New York, AIDS patients in their support groups, they go to a support group and someone would be missing and they would find out that the person had died. Well, then they found out what kind of treatment they were on, what kind of experimentation that the medical profession was doing with them. And by being aware of the disease and the current treatments for it, the AIDS patients themselves started monitoring their own care and had the doctors stop doing some of the things that were killing AIDS patients. So early on, AIDS patients a lot of times died from the effects of the treatment, and it wasn't until the AIDS patients got together and started comparing their treatments that they discovered this, and that's why it's important for people with AIDS to know as much as they can about the disease.
The form of the issues that the local ACT UP chapter took up are different than the issues you see other ACT UP chapters focusing on, because some of the kinds of things that ACT UP and other cities had to fight for, we didn't have to fight for. A lot of its focus was on the Department of Corrections, because early on there was a death of two prisoners with AIDS. They boycotted and picketed a local Christian daycare for refusing to take a child whose mother had AIDS. Dan Savage is one of the driving forces of the Madison ACT UP chapter. He was not a student here. He was an employee. Employee at Four Star Video at the time. When a doctor in the state prison system ordered nutritional supplements for a prisoner with AIDS, the prison only delivered the prisoner an extra peanut butter and jelly sandwich every day. That was the sort of thing that they fought. So, for instance, Dan Savage's response was to make sure that a peanut butter and jelly sandwich was delivered to the office of Governor Tommy Thompson every day for a year. You know, they did a flyover of the Waupun prison where they dropped condoms into the yard where the prisoners, you know, have their free time.
Chapter 7, 1982. Wisconsin becomes the first state to ban employment and housing discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, as told by David Clarenbach, Dan Curd, James Yaden, and Kathleen Nichols.
Laws unto themselves do not change social perspectives and public view towards our community. The laws are a vehicle from which social change can take place. I don't think one can occur without the other. But with respect to this gay rights law, you have to understand that there was no realistic prospect for any state to pass a gay rights law.
When I started work for David, he had already, which I'm sure you already know, he'd already introduced the gay rights bill before, and he'd introduced what he called, referred to as the consenting adults bill, because it was actually homosexuality, these physical act, was illegal in Wisconsin, along with cohabitation and, you know, fornication. They were actually in the statutes as being illegal. And when I joined him, he was progressively getting closer to passing what he called a consenting adults bill, but there had been no really concerted effort to forward the gay rights bill, because somehow it was thought that the consenting adults would have to be passed first. Uh-huh. You would have to decriminalize the act before you could, you know, ban discrimination.
It was my view to use public pressure to accomplish the following objective: to get 50 votes in the Assembly, 17 votes in the Senate, and the signature of one governor. I wasn't trying to get public opinion, although public pressure certainly was useful, but I didn't want the pollsters to get to the 51 percentile rate before we could make things happen. I wasn't going to wait until there were perfectly organized pressure groups within the gay and lesbian community or within the Republican Party or within the white range of religious perspectives, although all of those were essential to the process of getting the bill passed. My objective and the contribution that I could make towards the broader goal of social acceptance was to get this bill passed.
At Sunday's press conference, State Representative Dick Clarenbaugh, D.O. Madison, urged those present to take a half an hour every week to write to a legislator or kick in an extra $5 to keep the anti-discrimination effort going. Clarenbaugh said the sexual privacy bill was introduced 2 years ago and was now held up in committee because of parliamentary technicality, but we might get it passed next session. Alderman James Yaden, District 8, said the city's anti-discrimination ordinance in effect since May of 1975 didn't raise one word of opposition when it was first brought up, but he couldn't tell if in the wake of present trends there might be an effort to repeal.
Another legislator whose name is Dismas Becker showed up in David's office with this constituent of his named Leon Rouse. Leon had a lot of connections with, well, people like Archbishop Weakland in Milwaukee and the Episcopalian bishop. But anyway, Leon on his own had gone and had a gay anti-discrimination bill drafted with the LRB, Legislative Reference Bureau, and he came up with Dismas and they had this bill. And it was a different bill than David had drafted. I mean, it worked a little differently. We had he, of course, wanted someone to look at it, and they looked at it, and it was actually a much simplified version because it just took all the statutes that dealt with discrimination and added sexual orientation to them. At some point, there are discussions about who we had gotten support from, and it became apparent. I mean, this strategy developed. And I think it's the key to why it passed. Up until that time, any sort of gay rights bills were, when they were debated, they were like fiascos. I mean, but suddenly having all these religious people, and we went out and got more. Because, I mean, we knew in Madison there weren't nearly all, because I mean, it's a very liberal community. But we found out, even though the head of the American Baptist Conference, which is thought of as being conservative, that was supporting this because they considered it an issue of just a human rights issue, a civil rights issue. Also, surprisingly, I mean, it turned out there were people in the legislature who, surprisingly, we found were supporters of the bill on both sides of the aisle. I mean, I think that really took us aback. And once it passed one house, Drapa said if it passed the other, he would sign it.
I cannot overstate how much everyone who's queer in the world owes to David for being a skilled politician who completely understood how to amass political capital and being completely willing to spend it on what both coasts said couldn't possibly happen here. We were, in fact, actively discouraged by the antecedent organization to HRC from attempting to pass a gay rights law here, because surely we would fail and that would set the movement
right. The place I connected on campus was hearing about the ROTC unit and the fact that it was now under fire because it refused to admit gays and lesbians. And as soon as I found out that they did discriminate on the ground, I thought this is, in a sense, too hypocritical, because we have a state that doesn't discriminate, we have a city that doesn't discriminate, we have a campus that doesn't discriminate, and then we have these three federally funded organizations with all the stature and reputation they have who do.
Chapter 8, Faculty and Students Take on Discrimination in the ROTC, as told by Joe Elder and Jim Stakely.
Two students at UW-Milwaukee, Eric Jernberg and Leon Rouse, asked their school to adhere to the spirit of the new law by suspending participation in the ROTC program if that program continued to violate the terms of the statute. And they got the Milwaukee Faculty Senate to consider a motion, but it was not passed.
We created an organization called UW Faculty Against Discrimination in University Programs. There was the main person who was behind all of this was, of course, the undergraduate student Rick Villasenor, and Joe Elder in the sociology department was heading that up. It was extremely useful because because of his Quaker background, he He'd always had a kind of a pronounced position on the military, and also had this kind of social activism that comes from his background and also from the church background and everything. So he was a highly respected professor here on campus, well-known, who was a perfect person to head up our UW Faculty Against Discrimination. And so we started off by getting a petition. You had to, we looked at the UW rules, and Rick Villasenor looked at the rules, and found out that it's possible to call a meeting in the faculty to deliberate on an issue by getting the signatures of, don't hold me to this, I'd have to read the old newspaper clippings in the Cardinal on this, you know, 10% of the faculty, you have to get 10%, or something like that, you know, a certain percentage of the faculty has to sign a petition to do that. So we drafted this petition and then took it around and networked as best we could through our, you know, gay symposium group and in the different departments and everything, and got together all of the needed signatures.
So beginning in the, essentially the spring of 89, we got together the necessary votes, and the decision was that there would be an all-faculty meeting the next fall, which was indeed held on December 4th, 1989, and the vote had to do with whether the faculty would request the Board of Regents to terminate the university contracts with the Army, Navy, Air Force, ROTC programs, if those programs did not end discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation by May of 1993.
On December 4th, 1989, we had the first meeting of the full faculty since the Vietnam War era, and it took place at the Stock Pavilion right over there. And that's a building I hadn't been in up to that time, you know, but it was, we needed a big space to pull all those people together. And it was, oh, it was, wow, you know, it was like amazing because, you know, you had your ROTC supporters who wanted to keep the gay people out, people in uniform like crazy speaking, and the officers from ROTC and the university lawyers. And then they got this student group represented by David, well, anyway, our campus group, the 10% Society, you know, they wanted to have one student representative speak, the president of that. So all of these presenters, all of these speakers, and wow, it's historical, you know, you can look it up online, if by a vote of 386-248, the meeting of the faculty asked the Board of Regents to dismantle its contracts with ROTC. And at a meeting of the Board of Regents in February 1990, Donna Shalala, who was then our chancellor, and assistant president, Kenneth Shaw, recommended the university keep ROTC on campus. And the regents voted to do that, 13-3. But they agreed to lobby the Wisconsin congressional delegation to demand that the policy be changed at the federal level. And the university actually appointed a task force with other colleagues and universities to put pressure in Washington to change the policy.
Chapter 9, Madison Starts the Movement.
Well, you know, we made national news with that, and also these, you know, petitions and demonstrations and so on. It was getting to be on the national news, and the UW-Madison was kind of the first one out of the gate on this thing, but it spread in a sort of wildfire fashion to certain other campuses where there were similar protests going on, including at Harvard, so that it's now being discussed apropos of this nominee, Kagan, for the Supreme Court, who had took a position on that. Our committee, with Joe Elder as chair, also met with Wisconsin Congressman Les Aspin.
Students on campus were so upset at the region's decision that they continued to try and force the issue. And in April of 1990, they occupied Bascom for 5 days, demanding that the chancellor and assistant president sign a disclaimer to be put on all university orientation materials, noting the contradiction between U.S. system policy, state law, and the ROTC policy. And after 4 days with little positive response from the administration, they decided to ramp up their message, and they also occupied the Board of Regents room at the top of Van Hise, on the 18th floor of Van Hise. Well, that was the final straw for campus administration, and they broke up the Van Hise sit-in after 10 hours, and the police came in, and they arrested 40 students while a crowd of 300 chanted outside of Van Hise while these students were taken away.
both Shalala and Aspen left Wisconsin in 93 to join the Clinton cabinet. And she was the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and he was the Secretary of Defense. And so Aspen was the person who basically worked out together with Clinton the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. So this is also forged out of this, you know, it was a kind of a concession to the grassroots movement about the status of gays in the military.
It was national news. And the act, the student activism that followed was national news. And what this, it created, it's touched off an explosion of media coverage. And it created subsequent activism on other campuses around the country throughout 1990. In November of 1991, for example, the National Association of College and Universities released a statement endorsing efforts to change the ROTC policy because all of the 148 schools in the association had passed resolutions requesting ROTC to change its policy.
Now we've arrived at the 1992 presidential election. For the first time, candidates have to take a stand on the issue of gays in the military. George Herbert Walker Bush supported current policies, and Clinton said that one of the first things he would do in office is sign an executive order overturning the policy. Clinton's campaign promise never comes to full fruition, with Don't Ask, Don't Tell being touted as a compromise. After 20-something years of activism, the policy is finally overturned on September 20th, 2011. Chapter 10, A New Type of Meeting Place, The Founding of the LGBT Campus Center, as told by Elnisa Allgood.
We decided to hitch a ride with her. She dropped us off in Madison, and that was pretty much it. We didn't even have a place to stay.
Wow. How'd that work out? What'd y'all do?
I mean, it was fine. I mean, it was, you know, we got here, like, we came to a 10% society meeting. I think, like, that night, I mean, it was in summer, so we weren't, like, super worried about it. You know, we were just like, it's the summer. But, yeah, actually, like, we ended up staying in, like, the 10% Society offices, the ones in, like, the junky old buildings that are going to be ripped down sometime soon for a couple weeks, actually, I think, you know, you know, until we found some place to live and whatnot. And that's actually how the campus center got started, to be perfectly honest. Yeah, and it was just kind of one of those things. It was just like, well, I mean, Dean Ralph and, like, Jan Shepherd, I guess, you know, I mean, they pretty much had indicated that, well, you know, you could go through the Board of Regents, which, like, what everybody was doing, and they were fighting and fighting it year after year. It's like, or you could just go through student segregated fees. So, pretty much, like, yeah, a month later, I contacted Janice Shepherd with, like, a couple-page plan outlining the process and all of the other stuff. And we got approval, like, maybe 2 or 3 months after that, and we just had to wait for the next kind of like fiscal year for everything to kick in. So it was relatively easy to do. It's just that people were, like, so focused in on, like, one course of action that they just, you know, didn't step back to look to see what the other options were.
I think the campus, the LGB, and it was originally called the LGB, Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Campus Center opened on Thursday, September 10, 1992, at 336 West Dayton, which is in the Capitol Center complex. It was one of those first floor storefronts in the Capitol Center complex that students were able to rent out. So they could not get space on campus to create this, and so they rented space off campus. And it featured a lending library and a speakers bureau and support groups and a myriad of events for the community.
Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of stuff. In fact, actually, let's see, I'm trying to think. I mean, obviously, you know, we did, we initiated a number of support groups. Like, we had Bi Shy Y, I think there was a transgender group. There, you know, then there was, like, a coming out group. I definitely did not do that. I'm like, I actually am fairly supportive of people coming out, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, after, like, Penn State, I was just like, I will never do another coming out. I'm like, I do not have the proper mentality. there were like a couple of really good people who led like the coming out group, and we set up the space as like a meeting space. We really wanted to get people to like start using the space immediately. So it was a meeting space for some groups that had already existed and were trying to like find regular right. meeting space around town.
It continued as a student organization that had received yearly funding through the ASM of its time and continued to be run by students. There are problems with having not having continual funding, but having to sort of get your funding every year. And they had continual lease problems. People kept canceling their lease, and they kept moving around. So, like, their lease was canceled at Capitol Center, and so so they moved into an 8x8 office in Memorial Union in the spring of 1995. And then in the fall of 95, they moved into the Community Housing and Services Building at 306 North Brooks Street, which is the old YWCA on North Brooks. And then, you know, in the fall of 97, they moved into a space on State Street above what was then Kornblum's Shoe Store at 406 West Gilman, and then that lease got canceled, and then they finally got into the second floor space of Memorial Union in the fall of 1998, which is that space that they've been in until their recent move last, you know, 2 weeks ago to the Red Gym. And so eventually in 2003, they transitioned from a student organization funded mainly by student segregated fees to a unit of the Dean of Students Office with a paid full-time staff member.
This concludes our collection of highlights from the Madison LGBT Oral History Project, 1960s to present. We've only been able to share a fraction of the rich stories found in the collection, and there are many more still being told. If you would like to find out more about these topics and many others, please contact the Oral History Program or browse the interview collections at archives.library.wisc.edu. Once again, we would like to thank our oral history narrators, our historical consultant Scott Seiforth, and the New Harvest Foundation for making this project possible. Thank you.